Good morning. We're in the middle of a series called Faithful Love. And for those of us who are disciples of Jesus, we've experienced the faithful love of God and are given our lives to that. We see in Exodus 34 and verse 6, it says, the Lord is a compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in faithful love and truth. And then about 2,000 years ago, Jesus of Nazareth came to this earth, and he embodied that faithful love. And we read throughout the scriptures, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, these various accounts of his life, you see a man who lived out God's faithful love. And he was God himself, and he embodied for the world and demonstrated, most so demonstrating that on the cross as he gave himself up for all of us. And so in his life and in his death, we see God's faithful love. And on the night before his crucifixion, being led to the cross, he was with his disciples and he taught them and he gave them this new instruction. He says, "A new command I give you, love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another. As I have loved you." And so Jesus embodies the hesed, that Hebrew word for faithful love. He embodied God's faithful love, and then tells his disciples, "I want you to go live with this same faithful love." And then John, one of his disciples, many years after this, is able to say, "We love because he first loved us." We love because he first loved us. You and I have the ability to love and to know what love is in its truest form because God has first loved us. And now our job is just to have our cups filled up by the love of God and that we might overflow that love in all of our relationships that we have in our life. And that includes, as we've talked about in this series, that includes marriage, parenting, friendship, dating. But we're and today as we talk about this subject of sexuality. And you might think, well, what in the world does sexuality have to do with a relationship series? Or, in the words of the great philosopher with her 3-time Grammy awarding song, what's love got to do with it? What has love got to do with it? And that's what we're going to be asking this morning, is what does faithful love got to do with sex? And as you saw in your emails this week, if you're a member here and you got the email this week, we communicated there's a class for your kids, and we sent out that extra email. And I think that second email gave a little bit of anxiety to the room. Like, what's happening? Why are so many emails? This must be a very serious thing. Multiple people who came to me, and I just want you to understand that that's what we want to make it known to you when we're going to talk about more sensitive subjects. One, maybe you think, I want to invite my neighbor, but maybe this one wouldn't be a great one on the first one. Maybe it would, but I want to give you a heads up for that. And then two, understanding that to save you an awkward drive home to have a conversation you're not ready to have yet, I want you to know so you can do what's necessary for your kids. And then Lisa Wasilewski graciously offered to put on a class for the kids, and so that's why there were two emails. And so I just wanted to communicate that, nothing weird. Everything we talk about today, I don't think anything, even if you're a guest today, I don't think I'm going to say anything that surprises us. But I just do believe that we as a church need to talk about issues like this from time to time in order to teach the next generation, to teach ourselves, to remind ourselves of the truth that we believe in according to the way of Jesus, and things to remind ourselves for. So it's important to name. What does Jesus teach on these things? What's the biblical vision for sex? So we're going to talk about that this morning. So we're going to start off with this. We're going to go back to Genesis, and we're going to look at God's design for sex. And as we look at that, I want to start by saying this and just be very clear. There's not going to be a lot of hidden messages or kind of lead-ins to a big point. We're just going to talk clear about it today. And so the first point I want to make today is that God designed sex to nurture covenant love between a husband and a wife. God designed sex to nurture covenant love between a husband and a wife. So let's break that down for just a moment. As we look at creation, God had created the world, according to the record, in six days, and on the seventh he rests. But on that sixth day of creation, at the end of creation, some might say the pinnacle or the climax of creation, he creates humanity as sort of his crown jewel. And in doing so, he creates humanity in his own image. He creates him as male and female. And so in God's work here, as he creates humanity as male and female, he finishes his work. And as he looks at all that he has created, including humanity, I think especially humanity, he concludes his work and says, God saw all that he has made, and it was very good. And as God declares what he sees in his creation is very good, that includes every part of creation. And specifically, that includes every part of humanity. Male, female, masculinity, femininity, the two genders that God has created. And on top of this, God gives this vision of the goodness of male bodies and of female bodies. And then I believe also, as we break down this chapter, gives a vision for the sexual relationships that happen between male and female. I think that's seen in the next verse, as it simply says, God, or back in verse 28, that God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth and subdue it. Some of your translations will say, be fruitful and multiply, is maybe more familiar language. But it's simply this, that God gives humanity, he blesses humanity, says that they are good as they are as he created them, and then says, go, be fruitful, fill the earth. And I think that this phrase, be fruitful and increase in number, be fruitful and multiply, I actually think that that can mean a lot of other things too. I think God's giving them a charge to go out to create culture, go execute his goodwill on earth as it is in heaven. But I do think a part of that is, as it sounds, is to be fruitful and multiply, is to have relations with one another and produce offspring. Now, that being said, I want to clearly say that if you don't do that, or for whatever reason are unable to do that, that doesn't mean you're not living into God's purpose for you. As I've already said, there's all sorts of other ways that we carry this out as human beings. We are much more whole and bigger than that vision. But certainly, as the innuendo points to, part of that is the relations between a male and a female. However, that being said, God does put limits to that relation and how those relationships between male and female are to take place. And we see that in the next creation story in Genesis chapter 2, in the story of Adam and Eve, in the creation of Adam and Eve. And at that point, this is what it says. Therefore, this is Genesis 2, verse 24, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. In other words, God's giving like, hey, here's, like, go be fruitful and multiply, but here is like where that happens. And here's what that is designed, where that's designed to happen at. And you look at some of the language here for just a moment. First of all, the one that sort of grabs our attention at first is to become one flesh and what it means to become one flesh. We'll say more in just a moment. But I want to notice the word hold fast, because that's one that mine doesn't jump to as much and maybe overlooked. And if you grew up like me reading from the old King James, not the new King James, you liberals. I'm talking about the old King James. It would say, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. And now, of course, nobody knows what that means. And so the new translations put hold fast. Or the NIV, I like how it says it, be united to. But what's really interesting is that none of these words really truly capture what it means. It's not just like, go pick a suitable partner. But it's more than that. Tim Keller writes this. The word united, or in older translations, to cleave, means to make a binding covenant or contract. And this covenant brings every aspect of the two persons' lives together. And they essentially merge into a single legal, social, and economic unit. They lose much of their independence. And in love, they donate themselves wholly to another. And maybe you're thinking, for me, when I see the word united, I don't see those things. But for them, that the specific Hebrew word that's involved, they would have understood those things. That this was not just like saying, hey, go find someone who you're compatible with. It was more than that. It was go make a commitment with someone you feel compatible with. And make a legally binding commitment with one another. Hold fast. Be united. Well, how do I do that? In their times, they would have had their own ways. And every society has had its own ways of establishing it, even if it doesn't look like going at your county seat downtown and getting a paper and getting that signed. They had their ways of recognizing that. And I believe the original readers, certainly the Israelites, that's how they would have understood this passage. That what Paul, or what Moses in Genesis here is recording is that he's giving them a process for being fruitful and multiply, that they would have understood, just like you and I understand marriage and all that's involved in marriage, they would have understood it that way. And then this language of one flesh. As you think about that language, the two becoming one. Now, of course, the metaphor for that brings to your mind sexual relations. And it should, because I think that's the end of window. But it's so much more than that, isn't it? Marriage should be so much more than just that. It's becoming one in your intentions together, one in your vision for life together, one in how you navigate conflict and get along with one another, one in the way that you parent, one in the way that you guys decide you're going to serve and be on mission together. And so this idea of one flesh is that God's intention is that a man and a woman would make a covenant together, that is binding. It's a huge commitment that we're committing to, but that they would do so to love, serve, and make a life together. In other words, be fruitful and multiply, and whatever that would look like for their specific situation. And then the metaphor here to become one flesh, as I've said, clearly does allude to the sexual union of a married couple, but alludes to all the other ways that we become one together in a marriage relationship. But nevertheless, the sexual innuendo is prominent there. And I think the point here is that this is the design. This is God's design for sex. It's in a committed covenant, the biblical word covenant, relationship that is binding, that requires significant commitment and understanding the implications of that. And so, as we've said, God designed sex to nurture covenant love between a husband and wife. And before we move forward, I just want to kind of summarize here what we see, or what I see in the Genesis account, is that number one, our gender and bodies were created and blessed by God. Our gender and bodies were created and blessed by God. And both genders bear witness to the image of God. We each uniquely, male and female, uniquely bear the image of God to the world. And then the second thing is that sex was exclusively designed to be a major part of the union, uniting together through a covenant agreement, covenant contract, that word covenant, who made powerful commitments of a husband and wife, made powerful commitments to one another, and from the very beginning would have included whatever legal obligations or formalities were present. And like we said, even in the earliest societies. And then the last thing, as we move forward, I want to make it clear that this is a gift from God. That God has given us marriage as a gift and as a way for us to live out his purposes. Now, as we've noted last week, not all of us will make that decision. Not all of us will make this covenant. And there's room for that. Jesus of Nazareth is testimony that there's room to that. You can be fully human and not enter into that covenant and not practice sexual relationships. We see it in Paul as well. But nevertheless, when we do, it is a gift. And whatever discussion about sexual ethics we have or behaviors, our rules, quote unquote, they must flow from this Genesis vision of what God originally intended for creation, not arbitrary cultural traditions of our modern times, whether that be on either side of the issue. And so, the first point to clarify is God designed sex to nurture covenant love, committed love between a husband and a wife. And then the second thing is when sex is disconnected from covenant love, people get hurt. When sex is disconnected from covenant love, the general rule, I believe, is that people get hurt. To put it in our language from last week, it gets complicated. Not to say that sex is never complicated within the marriage relationship, it can be. But when sex is disconnected from covenant love, it gets complicated and people get hurt. So let's pull on that thread for the rest of our time here. I want to look over at, as we think about sex disconnected from God's design, I want to look over at 1 Corinthians 6, 12 through 20. If you have your Bibles, feel free to turn there with me. Or if you have your phones, you can pull up. Or I'm not going to have it on the screen, but you're welcome to just listen as we read through that. So 1 Corinthians 6, 12 through 20. And there's going to be some things that we're not going to be able to chase every thread in this passage, but we're going to read it and kind of make some points about it. If you'd like to, if there are things that you want to chase more, feel free to reach out to me. We'd love to talk more about this passage, but we're going to look at it more big picture. And understand, he's writing to a specific people in a specific time. There's going to be some things that don't quite click with us, but let's just walk through it together. Verse 12, Paul quoting a saying of the time, says, I have the right to do anything, you say, but not everything is beneficial. I have the right to do anything, but I will not be mastered by anything. You say, food is for the stomach and stomach for the food, and God will destroy them both. The body, however, Paul says, is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord and the Lord for the body. By this power, God raised the Lord from the dead. And he will raise us also. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ himself? Shall I then take the members of Christ and unite them with a prostitute? Never. Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in her body? For it is said, the two shall become one flesh. But whoever is united with the Lord is one with him in the Spirit. So flee from sexual immorality, and all other sins a person commits are outside the body. But whoever sins sexually sins against their own body. Do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have received from God? You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your bodies. First thing I kind of want to think there is, number one, you notice like the language is pretty strong. And if you're not a disciple of Jesus, you're with us today, like, yeah, it's strong language. But no, today as we talk about this passage, we're talking to the church. We're talking to people who are committed disciples of Jesus. And so I recognize maybe everyone here is not committed to following Jesus, and that's okay. But just understand, I'm not talking to you. It applies to all of us as human beings, but we're talking as an internal conversation to the church today. And that's what this passage is. This passage wasn't Paul's witness to the rest of the world. It wasn't a letter to the Chamber of Commerce in Corinth. It was a letter to the church. And he's talking to people who are following Jesus. And if we're following Jesus committed, we're in a covenant relationship with Jesus, then that has some implications. And so if you're not a disciple of Jesus, please listen in to this insider conversation, but recognize that we're coming from a certain worldview, and we cannot set that worldview aside as we talk about issues like this. So Paul has some strong language here. And so as we dive into that, a couple things here. We want to understand, what is the context? What was going on in Corinth? That's the city. When it says Corinthians, that's the city that this letter was written to the church who is in the city. And at that time, two things we kind of notice, the two thoughts Paul kind of engages with, if you will. He says, first, some will say all things are lawful or all things are beneficial there in verse 12. They're saying like, listen, and it's likely Christians were saying this. They heard Paul's message of grace. Well, if God is graceful and God's going to give us grace if we ask him, like, you know, all things are law, everything's on the table. We're no longer under that old law that was holding us back. Now we live in freedom. Paul wants to walk that back for just a moment. But also, food is meant for the stomach and stomach is for food. And they're both, we're going to die one day anyways and into a new reality. So why does it really matter what we do in the body now? And whether that was from the church saying that or whether that was the culture kind of saying some of these things, maybe it would be likely to saying something like this, that sex really isn't that big of a deal. Sex isn't really that big of a deal. It's just physical. It doesn't hurt anybody. I think at least how that relates to some of our cultural mindset would be today, that my morality, if can be shaped sometimes, well, if it doesn't hurt anyone, it must be okay. And that's kind of that mindset. It's not that big a deal. It's just physical. It doesn't hurt anyone. And so in Corinth and in the surrounding Greek and Roman world at that time, sex would have been treated as incredibly casual. Now, marage was very important as well. And so you would have your relationship with your wife, but then you'd protect that relationship because you're protecting an inheritance. You're protecting heirs to make sure you have the right heir. And so marriage was really important, and sex was treated casual, at least for the men. And so but it was very common for these husbands to have all sorts of these other relationships. And I think unmarried, kind of in the unmarried realm, that you'd see that among both. I'm not exactly positive, but I know at least for the men, it was treated incredibly casual. And one of the casualness of that, one of the indicators of that, is that you in Corinth, you had the temple to Aphrodite, god of fertility, god of sex. And you'd have, as it says, so what Paul's doing here, you kind of can trip us up on this language. He's not throwing shade at people who've gone into prostitution, although certainly we understand that's not God's vision for our lives, but it's understanding a lot of people were thrust into that without beyond their will, or it's not Paul criticizing the world around them. It's instead, and in fact, Jesus was known to be present with tax collectors, sinners, and prostitutes who he gathered around him, who he loved and sat at tables with. So that's not really the point. The point is, in their time, you could go to the temple of Aphrodite and you would sleep with the temple prostitutes. And I bring that out because it's directly there in the text. And it was seen as totally acceptable, married, unmarried, whatever the situation might be. And for Paul, he's addressing that. This church in the city where that was a cultural thing. And likely, it seems like some of the church could have been participating in that. We don't know that for sure. But Paul, at the very least, addresses it head on in order to address the situation. And here's his argument. It says, when you sleep with someone, you begin the process of becoming one flesh with them, whether you intend it or whether you don't. You are becoming, quote unquote, one flesh with them. In other words, sex has serious implications. You are uniting with that person. And as we've already highlighted, that God's intention for you to become one flesh with someone is intended to be within a covenant relationship between a husband and a wife. And so you can see why that's then problematic. Saying you're sleeping with this prostitute and you say it's no big deal, that's not someone I'm trying to pursue a relationship, it doesn't have that much meaning, it's just part of the culture, it's just part of the kind of how we do things today. And Paul says, no, it's much more serious than you think. And much more is happening in that. And so, as we look at this then, as Paul emphasizes that the sexual union that joins two people together in a profound way goes so far beyond the physical. As we said, sex is a beautiful thing. It's a gift to be received But when sex is disconnected from a covenant relationship, problems are created. Problems are created. I probably don't even have to say that, because we can go through our testimonies, we can go and look at all that's going on in our culture around us, and we just realize that things get complicated really quickly. And I believe that's because it's beyond what God ever intended for the design of sex. And with that, and therefore, our Christian language is, yes, it's a sin. We do believe that. But probably not for the reasons many people would think. It's not because of some religious moralism or we think we're better than people, but because the Christian ethic says, listen, this is serious. You're joining together with someone in a way you probably don't comprehend and understand, in a way that none of us do. But that the joining of two souls together in a practice that was intended between deep commitment and a covenant relationship, when you remove that covenant relationship or do it outside of that covenant relationship, things get complicated. And there's going to be pain involved, not only for the other person. And that's important for you to understand. Even if you think it's not hurting someone else, it's harming them in ways that we aren't going to be able to comprehend, but ways that I believe that we relate to and at least we get. We know that to be true. But Paul's real point here, which is powerful, is that in doing so, not only are you hurting other people, you're perpetuating the system of temple prostitution in their time. And probably there's probably people involved in that who didn't want to be involved in that. But at the same time, Paul says the big thing is, like, this is a sin in which you are sinning against yourself. Like, by doing these things, whether you recognize it in the moment or not, you're doing harm to yourself. Like, this is not the way you were created. This is contrary to how your soul was created. And it does great harm. And so when we look at our culture today, a few things to say here. You know, our culture is very different than Corinth. And sometimes, you know, I talk with people and say, like, the Bible just doesn't connect to, like, modern times. But then as we start to read Scripture together, people are amazed how relevant it really is. Because we may not be ancient Corinth with a temple to a god of fertility or a god of sex, but I really don't think we're that different than Corinth. Because today, I see a culture, and I get it. I understand it. I live in this culture where it feels like, well, what does love really got to do with it? What does love really got to do with it? Or another way to say that for us, what does covenant really have to do with this? Like, I'm not in it for commitment. I'm not, you know, I'm not trying to make any big life choices here. But what does that have to do with sex? What does that have to do with how I show up to my relationships with the opposite sex? And I want to look at that. And by the way, no critique of Tina Turner here. I wasn't born yet when this song was written. And I don't know motivations. I don't even know truly the meaning of the total song, but I want to break down the first verse. It says, "You must understand, though the touch of your hand makes my pulse react, it's only the thrill of a boy meeting girl. Opposites attract. It's physical. It's only logical. You must try to ignore that it means more than that." But it does. And that's Paul's point in 1 Corinthians 6. Whether we recognize it or not, or we can see it in the moment or not, when we have sex outside of covenant, and when you have sex within your marriage covenant, it has profound meaning. So much so that we're told that this covenant marriage relationship somehow testifies to Christ and the church in Ephesians 5 and somehow reveals some of the mystery of God. And, you know, it's a mystery. We don't quite understand that. But it has profound implications for the joining of two souls together. And so as we think about this in our situation today, in our culture treats sex incredibly casual. And the problem with that, the problem with sex outside of marriage or before marriage or whatever context, not within God's original design, the problem with that is that we remove, we're seeking intimacy of the covenant outside of the covenant, outside of a committed, deeply formed relationship or deeply formed commitment. And I'll encourage our young people in the room, as you're dating, as we talked about last week, is the more you step into that realm, the more the lack of clarity you actually have in trying to decide if someone's compatible with you. Because sex has a way of producing chemicals in our brain that affects how we think. And in order to be sober-minded, to be clear about discerning the will of the Lord, we need to be careful with that. And it is hard. And something that was incredibly helpful to me in my life was older members sharing with me, like, yeah, this is hard. And you're in a culture where this is hard. And we're in a culture that says you really don't know the other person unless you've engaged and dabbled in some of this so that you know what you're looking for. But when we do that, hearts are broken. When relationships break, hearts shatter when we've gone in this direction, because those things were playing with something that was meant for a deeply committed part of our covenant relationship in marriage. And then the second thing I want to mention with that in our culture is the rise of living together and the rise of cohabitation, which has risen like several percentage points, 10s, 20 percentage points since this song would have first been written. And again, the problem with that, which is almost always coupled with a sexual relationship, is when we live together outside of marriage. The problem with that is, again, that we're getting the benefits of the covenant relationship of marriage without the covenant, without the commitment, without the decision to say, we're doing this together. God be our witness, and then doing that within the cultural means. That we're doing that outside of that. And so in doing so, I really think it comes from a good place for most people, is that wanting the closeness, wanting security, wanting partnership, while keeping the relational or relation conditional. Is, I'm not ready to commit yet. Well, of course you're ready to commit. You're doing all the things that a married couple would do. And it's important to think about that, because it has profound things. And because when those relationships don't work out, it hurts even more. And those and things get a lot more complicated when you try to undo something that wasn't bound together by covenant. It becomes challenging. And it seems logical to test compatibility, to save money, but the reality is you're doing harm to your own relationship. As the stats have consistently shown over time, that this practice actually increases the rate of divorce later on. Not always, the general trend. So I challenge that, because when you're doing so, you're practicing marriage without the commitment of marriage. And I think what Paul says here applies. You're becoming one flesh with someone you've not committed to. And then the last thing I want to mention here is pornography, which, again, when we talk about pornography, it is sexual gratification, I want to be clear here, detached from commitment. And oftentimes detached from, or not oftentimes, it's also detached from an actual person, an actual present person. And so it's no different from the other things. It's just, it's seeking that pleasure outside of the originally designed way that God designed it. And the science is well established on this, that it does harm, it does a certain amount of harm to your brain, and that your capacity for relationship and intimacy can be greatly hampered when you participate and seek those things out. And so I just reinforce the point of this lesson is that God designed sex to nurture. It's a gift, but it's designed to nurture covenant love between a husband and wife. And when sex is disconnected from covenant love, we get hurt. Like, what person can raise their hand in here to say, is if you've gone that road, that you haven't been hurt by that? And as we look at the numbers on that, the stats show that the majority of the people in this room have been affected by this one way or another. And if you look at Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, he would say all of us have been affected by this one way or another. Is the where sex or sexual thoughts or sexual passions are disconnected from covenant love, like, it just doesn't do good for us. It doesn't put us in the position to live, one, if we're disciples of Jesus, within his way, but also even disconnected from that. It just, we see stats on things, it just does more harm than it does good. And I think we know that in our bones. I think we know that these practices truly are not good for us or the people that we're involved with. And we have seen the pain that comes from these things, and pain that we either, and I'm just going to say this, pain that we either have participated in creating or on the other side of it is pain that we've experienced because something was forced upon us that we never asked for. And we need to recognize that as well. As we bring this lesson to a close, I want to say this, is that the sermon is not meant to create shame, but it's meant to challenge us. Because this is a place, if we can't talk about this here, where else can we talk about this? That we as the church ought to be able to have these conversations. So not to create shame. Because again, I fully believe that each one of us have been affected by this in one way or another, and we have felt the pain of it. And so for us, as we think about this, is we need to recognize that that we all need the grace of God. In fact, when you go back to verse 11 in chapter 6, Paul lists all these people who are not living their lives in alignment with the kingdom. And in verse 11, he lists those who've fallen in some of these ways, as so many of us have. He says, and that is what some of you were. He says, but you were washed, you were sanctified, and you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of our God. And so this is my first kind of quick 3 points of application here. Is one, we must accept the faithful love and grace of God. There is nothing that you can do that would separate you from the love of God. There's nothing. Whatever your story is, whatever your past is, and maybe it goes back generations, like God was with you every moment. We just maybe weren't aware of it. And so our life is about becoming aware that God is with us, for us, and in us if we are disciples of Jesus. And even if we're not, he is working to help write your story, and he is with you. We're going to make mistakes. We don't get it right. You may leave today and have a failing of some kind. But God is always on the doorstep, as it says in Luke chapter 15, seeing you afar off. And when he sees you, he runs down that driveway to come and to receive you. And we need to accept the faithful love and grace of God. Because I realize, and that was part of why I want to mention that in the email leading into this, I realize we all have stuff in our past, and there's things that this may trigger some shame. And I don't want it to do that. I want it to lead you to the love and the grace of God. And we need to do the work, yes, do the work of accepting the love and grace of God, becoming awareness of God's goodness and love. And then the second thing is we do need to surrender our sexuality. And I understand to our times today, that sounds oppressive, that sounds strict, that sounds repressive. I get that. But part of being a disciple of Jesus, the way we define disciple here in Northeast is to follow someone learning to follow Jesus, be changed by Jesus, and join the mission of Jesus. And part of being a disciple of Jesus is to be changed by him. And that's not a popular message in our culture today, is that we should be accepted as we are. But anyone who comes into the presence of God under the way and teachings of Jesus will not stay the same as they are. And Jesus, he has a heart, he has grace for when we've messed that up, when we haven't got it right. But he invites us in. He says, but that's fine, let me heal that, but let me teach you a new way. Let me teach you a different way. And we all need that message. And we all have to surrender our sexuality to Jesus. And that looks like there's so many resources out there. There's practices. There's committing to spiritual disciplines. All the types of things that can prepare us to surrender that before Jesus. We're told by our culture that you cannot be fully human unless you express yourself in this way. And the way of Jesus says different. As we see Jesus walk in that way. And you want to know who we learn to surrender our sexuality to Jesus from? We learn it from Jesus. Because he did that very same thing as well as the Apostle Paul while he was on this earth. And we're just following in his path, whatever that path looks like for you, whether it's single or married, whatever it might look like, we follow in that path. And then the last thing here is that we need to walk compassionately with others. Because there's people in our life who are hurting. There's people in our life who are challenged by these things or have fully accepted these things. And we need to be compassionate. We're not going and telling the world how they ought to live. We're going and trying to point people to Jesus and to lead people to Jesus. Because listen, if Jesus is not king of my life, then it doesn't matter how I engage in these ways. Yeah, I might be hurt by it, but if that's my worldview, it really doesn't matter. This matters. If I believe Jesus is the Christ, if I believe he was risen from the dead, and I believe in the story that he believed in, which is the creation of all things, then this, okay, you've got my attention. And so we need to be compassionate with people. They're not coming from the same direction or the worldview that we have, so we need to walk compassionately with others who are in our life who don't see it this way. And even those who are in the church, who have accepted these lifestyles and are doing these things, we need to walk compassionately with them. Lead them, be with them, be close, draw close, not far away, but lead them to the heart of Christ. And at some point, there will be a point where, yes, we will have the opportunity to have a conversation, and we will have to say some things that sound hard. But it's at that point, the only fingers that are pointed in that instance are a finger towards Jesus, and then I think a finger towards ourselves as we share our testimony and our own brokenness and our own struggles as we walk alongside them. Now, this kind of closing image here. We've shared this image a couple times in a couple different sermons this year. It's of signposts. And N.T. Wright talks about there's so many aspects of life that are like these broken signposts, meaning they're supposed to point to something, but because of the nature of the world and because of our cultural ideas, they kind of get broken. And you kind of come up on a signpost and you see it pointing in a direction, but you can't see the full picture because it's broken. And I believe that we've talked about all kinds of different issues, and I think sex is one of these things. They point to something greater than ourselves. These various signposts do. They point us towards God. Because he is the one, when we talk about finding union and finding satisfaction in life, he is the only one who can fully provide us for that. And our covenant with him is more important than any other covenant that we make in this world, this commitment to be in relationship with. And there's this old story of Augustine, we talked about last week. And there's a story about when he first became a Christian. He had lived a life where he had several different partners before becoming a Christian. But after he did, he totally was transformed. And he was walking downtown one day in his city, and he comes up and walks past one of his former lovers, and she says to him, "Augustine, it is I." And he walks right past her, and she said, "Augustine, it is I. Why did you walk past me?" And he turns to her and compassionately says, "Yes, my dear, but it is no longer I." And that is the calling for all of us in whatever situation it might be, but especially as we think about surrendering our sexuality before God and finding our ultimate satisfaction in him. And then last week, we ended our lesson on this, this saying of Augustine, who's this early 4th century church writer. He says, "You have made us for yourself, Lord, and our heart is restless until it rests in you." And I truly believe whether it's dating, sexuality, or whatever it might be, whatever issue we might be talking about, I think so many of our issues as human beings go back to this restlessness that is in us. And this morning, we're going to pray this like we did last week. But this morning, if you have a need, if you'd like to take a step into our prayer room and just pray with some elders, maybe some things heavy on your heart, or maybe there's some people in your life who you're concerned with because they're hurting because of these things. And you want to be a testimony, you want to be a witness to them. Whatever your need might be, a couple of our elders will be in the prayer room as you enter the Kidman hallway. But let us live into this vision and recognize if there's a restlessness in us, the way we can find satisfaction in that, we can find rest, is in God alone. So if you will, let's stand together and we'll pray this prayer. And then Ben will lead us in our next song. Dear Lord, you have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our heart is restless until it rests in you.